Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this July 8th panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are hosting the argument by Zoom rather than live. So, counsel, as I'm sure you are well aware, after all of the experience you've had going through this process, that we are making an audio recording, not a video recording of the proceedings. So despite the fact that we can see each other now and we can see everyone's names, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the sake of our audio recording of the presentation today. Please be mindful of the timing restrictions, which will be indicated on the screen. And if we have any glitches during the process, technologically, if you can't hear someone or someone's dropped off from your view, just flag us and we'll try to pause the proceedings and help us to catch up with the technology. Now with that, our first case for oral argument this morning is Smallwood versus State of Minnesota Department of Human Services. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those timing restrictions and adjust, make sure your argument ends on time. Counsel, for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
May it please the court. Thank you very much, Your Honor. This is Peter Nikitas appearing on behalf of Curtis Smallwood. This is an appeal of a final Rule 12 judgment in light of the case of Halva against Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, 953 Northwest 2nd 496, Minnesota 2021, decided 3 weeks after the appeal filing. Mr. Smallwood states claims that require reversal and remand. After addressing the facts, I will address the following points, Your Honor. Standard for review, analysis of Minnesota statutes 13.05 and 0.055. Standing, nominal damages, special damages, exemplary damages, compensatory damages under the Data Practices Act, equitable relief, the factual nexus that Mr. Smallwood has drawn in compliance with Halva, equitable relief, and he will address the Minnesota Health Records Act, and then he will conclude.
And well, I hope you'll have time to cover all of that, but I think that would happen only if we didn't ask you any questions, but I'm going to interrupt you with one to start.
Yes.
Your complaint raises concerns of about the Minnesota Data Practices Act, 1305, subdivisions 4 and 5. So subdivision 4 prevents the dissemination of data or the improper use, collection, or storage of it. And subdivision 5 imposes a requirement for procedures ensuring that data are not improperly disclosed. I think I understand your argument as to subdivision 5. I'm a bit lost as to subdivision 4. Is it your position that subdivision 4 imposes a sort of strict liability so that if someone steals data from a public entity, that is tantamount to dissemination, which ordinarily is thought of as an active conduct?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The answer is as follows. You asked whether the act imposes strict liability, and a previous panel of this court addressed that question of Mantuffel against City of North St. Paul in 1997, and they found it simply a statutory violation and did not find it to be an intentional tort nor a negligence statutory cause of action, but simply looked at pointed to litigants and the courts look at the facts and see whether there's a violation.
Right. I'm talking about the terms that are used under subdivision 4. And thank you for that response as to strict liability. Maybe I'm not so much talking about a mens rea element, but about the actual conduct. I'm trying to get a sense of how an individual stealing data from the government when the government was trying to protect the data would be tantamount to the government's dissemination of data, given the statute's terminology.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The two statutes work, two subdivisions work hand in hand to require the responsible authority to keep private government data secure from unauthorized dissemination. And the 2014 amendment to the Data Practices Act in the 2014 amendment to the Data Practices Act, which amended 1305 and 13055, makes it very clear that there is no hacker exception to the Data Practices Act. Because just looking at the facts of this case.
Wait a minute, I saw that in your brief. What is the actual amendment that you think makes the theft, the hacker taking the data, an act of dissemination by the government? What's the language in the statute that leads you to that conclusion?
Okay, the 13.055 defines terms, and 1305 subdivision 5A lays it all out, Your Honor. Okay, just addressing the facts here, Commissioner Lowry admitted to Mr. Smallwood, and I'm just quoting the letter that the Attorney General included, that on or about March 28, 2018, a hacker was able to gain access to state email account of an employee in direct care and treatment, DCT. Once the hacker gained access, the hacker pretended to be a DCT employee and sent two emails to one of the DCT employee's coworkers, asking the coworker to pay a quote unquote invoice by a wire transfer. And the commissioner admitted that the breach took place more than 1 year after he notified Mr. Smallwood. In so doing, the commissioner admitted 1 year after the fact that a person with no need to know Mr. Smallwood's private government data breached the data security of the state email account of an employee of Department of Human Services Direct Care and Treatment Administration, and made unauthorized acquisition of Mr. Smallwood's private government data in breach of Minnesota Statute Sections 13.055 Subdivision 1A through D, 13.05 Subdivision 5A2, and 13.08 Subdivision 1. In so doing, the commissioner admitted 1 year after the fact that a person, quote, whose work assignment did not reasonably require access to Mr. Smallwood's private government data, disseminated this private government data twice in two separate emails to another DCT employee to generate a phony invoice to get the money at state expense.
Mr. Nikitas, though, in your complaint, do you allege that this person was an agent of the agency or an employee of the agency? I mean, I think that's the question that Judge Ross is getting at. Is this a dissemination by the agency, or are we only really looking at that subdivision 5A about whether or not the agency established appropriate security safeguards?
The statute does not does not have a hacker exception, Judge Siegel. The fact of the unauthorized dissemination is a violation of the act according to its plain words. Whether the hacker is not an agent of the commissioner, that would be absurd to think that. The DCT employee received this phony invoice, and monies were paid at the expense of the state treasury and at the expense of Mr. Smallwood's private government data. And there is no intent. There is no agent. There is just a violation of the plain words. And as the
Hold on.
Yeah.
You keep saying a violation of the plain words. I think when I look at, and I'll ask your opponent this question, because I think your opponent seems to fail to address subdivision 5. But what are the plain words in subdivision 4 that are violated? What was the maybe I should ask you this way. What do you allege was the dissemination, and by whom?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. The dissemination was laid out by the commissioner, and it was his.
But it does say by government entities. I guess that's where my question is. Is subdivision 4 talks about that private or confidential data shall not be collected, stored, used, or disseminated by government entities for any purpose other than. So is it your argument that it really doesn't have to be by the government entity, but that a hacker going in, that constitutes a dissemination by the government entity?
Your Honor, that's a great question, and I would say that the cause of action more appropriately lies on 1305 subdivision 5. 1305 subdivision 4 establishes mandatory duties that govern collection, processing, dissemination of private and confidential data and storage of the same. And 1305 sub 5 makes it very clear that there is no hacker exception here. And the government does not get a pass when it's hacked, okay? And—
Okay, I think I understand your argument better. Thank you for that clarification. Can you turn to sovereign immunity?
Sure.
MHRA, what is the language of the MHRA that you believe most clearly, unequivocally establishes the government's intent to waive its sovereign immunity, the state's attempt to waive its sovereign immunity?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. First of all, the Supreme Court makes it clear in Nichols that an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity is not required. As to the language of the Minnesota Health Records Act, the language that manifests the waiver of sovereign immunity is at 144.50 and 144.291 subdivision 23I, which makes the Department of Human Services a regulated entity answerable to the Department of Health. And 144.291 makes it clear that every entity that is regulated, including the state, listed under 144.51 subdivision 1, is accountable under the Minnesota Health Records Act. Then we turn to 144.298, the penalties section. You look at subdivision 2, liability of provider or other person. Before we go there, let's look at 144.293 subdivision 2, which prohibits a provider from dissemination of health records and health of the nature that the commissioner admitted in his letter to Mr. Smallwood. And subdivision 2 of 144.298 states liability of provider or other person. So we're talking about the liability of a provider, and the Department of Human Services is a provider as the Health Records Act defines it. The rest of the statute goes on to say a person who does any of the following is liable to the patient for compensatory damages. But, okay, I see I got the 3 minutes and 20 seconds left, but I'm gonna answer your question, Your Honor. So the answer is 144.298 subdivision 2 with reference to 144.298 sub 293 subdivision 2, 144.50 and 144.291 subdivision 3I. And
well, let me pause you for there.
Sure.
So 144.291 subdivision 2 includes definitions. One of those definitions is a provider. And a provider is defined under four different subparagraphs.
Yes.
If you have that handy.
I do, Your Honor.
Which one of those subparagraphs do you say applies here in the steps that you're suggesting we include in our sovereign immunity analysis?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. It's 144.291 subdivision 2I(1) and 3.
So subdivision 1 refers to a person who furnishes. So how would a person, before we get to 3, how would that definition of person fit?
This makes reference to chapter 151, and under 151.58, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program is identified as a person who is regulated under chapter 151. And That's for number one. Now for number three, the Department of Human Services and specifically the Minnesota Sex Offender Program are licensed under Chapter 144. And Your Honor, I will make a reference to 246 Bravo 0.03, which mandates that the Department of Health govern the Department of Human Services sex offender programs as a secure living facility. That's absolutely plain. Okay, so that addresses the sovereign immunity. If I see that I've got a couple of minutes, Your Honor. If I
well less than that,
more than happy to. Actually, it's 38 seconds, so I'll reserve whatever time I have. But I, relative to compliance with HALVA, he laid out the facts. He connected it to his nominal damages, special damages, his compensatories and exemplaries. I add that special damages are clearly appropriate. They properly pled, and in the federal credit record FCRA cases, both equitable relief to prevent those breaches and awarding special damages for credit monitoring are perfectly appropriate. And I'll reserve the balance of my time, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Well, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, I am Drew Bredesen, Assistant Attorney General representing respondent, the Minnesota Department of Human Services. A hacker gained access to an email account and sent an email attempting to defraud the state with a false invoice. That email account had some information about appellant in it, but did not have financial information or a social security number. The district court correctly conducted a Rule 12 analysis and dismissed appellant's MGDPA and MHRA claims based on this event for failing to state a claim. Now on appeal, appellant is arguing that HALVA, issued after the district court's decision, rewrites the rules of civil procedure and pleading standards such that now any conclusory claim passes a motion to dismiss without requiring a Rule 12 analysis of the legal sufficiency of the pleaded facts. Appellant's argument is incorrect because HALVA only clarified that a plaintiff may plead conclusory harm, not that a court must accept a plaintiff's legal conclusion that the pleaded facts state a claim. So instead, the district court properly considered whether the pleaded facts stated a claim under either act and correctly dismissed appellant's claims, which dismissal should be affirmed. So first, regarding HALVA, what the Supreme Court did was clarify the pleading standard in Minnesota. Previous precedent had been construed as permitting dismissal for damages which were remote and speculative. The Supreme Court clarified that that remote and speculative bar is applied at the summary judgment stage, not before. The Supreme Court then analyzed whether HALVA's allegations were sufficient to survive a Rule 12.02 motion to dismiss, accepting that conclusory harm that was pleaded, but also finding that HALVA's complaint sufficiently identified the facts that gave rise to his claim, more specifically that those pleaded facts were found to have violated the Data Practices Act. So because HALVA adequately pleaded facts stating a legal claim, adequately pleaded the factual nexus linking those claims, those facts to the claimed harm, and adequately pleaded the resulting conclusory harm, the complaint survived the motion to dismiss.
Go ahead, Judge Ross, sorry.
I don't understand your argument after HALVA. Here you've got a complaint where the complainant says, my data was breached, there was a violation of the Data Practices Act, I've suffered harm, it refers to emotional distress out of concern for the loss of data. You've acknowledged that even though there was some data that was private that wasn't released, there was other data that was, I say released, that was hacked. I guess I'm not clear of the step that HALVA requires that you say is not met here.
Thank you. So the distinction here is that appellant is making a legal conclusion that what happened constitutes a release of data that violates either act. So what about the primary issue with this appeal is that
I was focusing on the harm and the damages part of the analysis that Halvo was referring to. So it sounds like your argument is really based upon your position and the district court's conclusion that there was no data practices violation alleged.
That's correct. The respondent is arguing that the Rule 12 analysis is appropriate and that that results in a conclusion that neither act was in fact breached.
Oh,
because
okay.
no disclosure occurred under either act.
I see. So that's the basis of your damages argument under Halva, is that that's the element that's missing, is the violation of the actual statute, the Data Practices Act.
Correct. The facts do not state a legal claim, but also there is no factual nexus that links the claimed conclusory harm to the claimed violation.
Well, that's the part I'm lost in. There's an allegation that data was released. It was hacked. And the allegation is that that's a violation of the Data Practices Act. Let's assume that we believe that that does constitute a potential violation of the Data Practices Act under Subdivision 5, just for the purposes of this question. Assume that's so. What remains of your argument under Halva?
So we then turn to Scheffler, which requires a plaintiff to show how the claimed injuries resulted from the incident that occurred. So here what we have is, yes, there is a factual question there is a fact that is absent here of there being any actual access or disclosure, but there's also the legal conclusion that resulted in a violation of either act. Taking your hypothetical, that there was in fact access to that data, that does not result, there is no factual nexus there to suggest that the harm stems from that. For instance, it is not a reasonable inference that identity theft could occur without financial information, that that fear of financial impact could result when there is already these IRS letters predating.
Well, wait a minute. Why does it have to be financial? Why can't the damages be emotional? I mean, my private information was released. I'm assuming that we all agree that there's a substantial amount of private information that one would suppose that the government holds if you were in Mr. Smallwood's shoes, that there's a whole lot of really personal data. And if you're informed that there was a hack and the data was released, okay, so no social security number was released, no financial data was released. Maybe you can't have identity theft. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But are you suggesting that any emotional distress that might result from that type of a breach would not be grounds for liability under the Data Practices Act if in fact there was a data practices violation?
I would like to clarify that Halva does permit harm to be pleaded in a conclusory fashion, but we still need to connect those two things. So accepting the legal conclusion that either the MHRA or the MGDPA was breached, there still needs to be that factual nexus, that fair traceability that is there in both Scheffler and Halva. And assuming that...
What more would you possibly need to plead if you're Mr. Smallwood, that there was private data that you're holding, you failed to secure that data, a hacker got to that data, assuming that the failure to secure was a breach, I don't quite understand what you're asserting needs more to be alleged to establish at least a claim under Rule 12.
Certainly. So in a different world, there are potentially different critical facts that could change the situation. If we didn't have a letter that appellant is basing his claim upon, which is providing the entire factual background here. And secondly, if we would need a factual nexus that included that information actually being released. In other words, the data is accessed or goes somewhere, and that the person actually being sued caused the release.
Well, it did go somewhere. It went to the hacker.
Certainly. And to be clear, this court, of course, has, you know, de novo review of the legal sufficiency of those pleadings. The priority in this case is to be clear that HALVA in no way removed the ability for a district court to conduct a Rule 12 analysis. So no court is required to adopt the appellant's legal conclusions that a dissemination or a release occurred, or that that would constitute a violation of either act.
So can I ask a quick question? Is it a violation of the act to fail to establish appropriate security safeguards under 1305 subdivision 5A? Is that an independent violation, or are you saying the only way to violate the Government Data Practices Act is to fail to disclose, you know, data when the act says it needs to be disclosed, or to improperly disseminate private or confidential data?
Certainly. So yes, of course, 13055 does require that there be the disclosure when there is actual acquisition of data, which is what that section refers to. Subdivision 5 of 1305 refers to, the responsible authority's requirement to establish appropriate security safeguards for the data on those individuals. So the question of whether security safeguards are appropriate would be a legal conclusion. And that,
no,
again,
my question is could that form the basis for a cause of action? An allegation that the agency failed to establish appropriate security safeguards. I mean, that in and of itself could state a cause of action, correct? Under the Data Practices Act?
A validly pleaded set of facts that go to that violation would state a claim.
Okay.
What do you mean validly pleaded? So in this case, there's an allegation that I think if we take all the inferences in favor of the complaint, we would say that the government agency failed to meet its obligations under 1305 or 13.05. Now, obviously, there's an argument that that's not so, a factual dispute about that. But are you suggesting that the complaint and its inferences wouldn't allow for that conclusion, at least at the stage of Rule 12?
Yes, I am arguing, respondent's position is that, for instance, under Walsh, the assessment is what reasonable inferences can be drawn from the facts that were alleged in the complaint. And the reasonable inferences that can be drawn do not include the fact of a dissemination. They do not include the fact of disclosure, and they don't require this court or the district court to avoid a Rule 12 analysis of whether those facts constitute a legal, as a matter of law, a violation of either act.
Well, hold on. So subdivision 5A2 requires the government to establish appropriate security safeguards, and that includes procedures to ensure that the data are only accessible to those individuals who have the authority to see the data, and that the data is only being accessed by those persons. Why doesn't the complaint and its reasonable inferences support the fact, the assertion that in this case, the department didn't do that, didn't establish appropriate security safeguards that would ensure that the data would not be accessible to, say, a hacker?
Certainly. So that is not a fair inference to make in this case. Certainly. And for multiple reasons. The first, again, is that it's a legal question of whether or not safeguards are appropriate. But further, and on that point also, there the pleadings do not require that as a result of this incident. So what the pleadings state is that there was a access to a hacker gained access to an email account. That does not result in that does not require the result that any information was in fact accessed as a matter of law. And that does further does not require an inference that anything that the security procedures were inadequate. Neither of those things are fair inferences. What we have is someone who gained who forced access and was immediately caught. You know, this
why
person.
Why doesn't the fact that someone in the public gained the access to the information at least provide the inference that it wasn't sufficiently protected from that event occurring?
First, because the legal conclusion is not required that access by hacking means that there are inappropriate security safeguards.
I'm not suggesting that the complaint proves it, but I'm saying why doesn't it at least establish a reasonable inference that there wasn't appropriate safeguards? If the government's responsible to keep it safe and somebody outside the government gets it, why don't we at least draw the inference, allow the inference that allows a fact finding on the question as to appropriateness of the government's protection? Why isn't that enough to show a violation or possible violation?
Certainly, and I'm conscious of time, but I'll just try to answer the court's question before concluding here. The sensitive situation here is that we need to keep in mind that from post-Halva and Scheffler and Walsh, there is still a Rule 12 analysis all along of whether or not the facts that were stated were validly state a claim, establish that factual nexus, and plead conclusory harm as it is permitted. So that analysis continues throughout. In conclusion, the Rule 12 analysis of the legal sufficiency of pleaded facts remains appropriate after Halva. And because appellant failed to plead facts constituting a claim under the MGDPA and MHRA, and moreover failed to plead an injury fairly traceable to those violations, the appellant's claims were correctly dismissed, and respondents respectfully request that dismissal to be affirmed.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal? You are muted, so we only Judge Siegel is
okay,
capable.
Thank you. Let me address a couple of points, Your Honor. The district court dismissed the data practices claim for not recognizing the damages that Mr. Smallwood properly pleaded. And the Halva case changed that. As a matter of fact, following Halva, a couple of district courts in Ramsey County have denied dismissal, citing Halva. And I would direct Your Honor to pages addendums 4 and 5 of the principal brief, which have Judge Gruing's decision, and especially addendum page 8. Judge Gruing writes, "The court is troubled by the reality that an untold number of people, including the plaintiff, had their private information compromised by the cyber attack that happened on March 26, 2018. This type of breach undermines the credibility of the Minnesota Department of Human Services and of the Minnesota state government." I'm hearing the commissioner continuing to apologize and rationalize, and that's unacceptable in the face of the objective reality of a hack and the plain words of the statute.
I'd like you to address the state's argument as to subdivision 5, that the term appropriate, establish appropriate security safeguards, is a legal question, not if I'm inferring correctly from the argument, that's not a factual dispute, that's a legal question.
Your Honor, I disagree with the commissioner's point of view. Appropriate is a is a word, is an adjective that has a lot of give to it. And it's a word that it's a matter that can't be disposed of at Rule 12. And at the very best, Rule 56. Now, when it comes to pleading a failure to keep private government data secure from unauthorized dissemination and access, this has been within the plain words of the Act. The 2014 amendment shored it up, and I direct Your Honor's attention to the reply brief, page 6, quoting Don Gemberling in his law review article. And he's quite a scholar on the Data Practices Act, and he points out that phrasing a cause of action of the failure to keep secure private government data would have been valid back in 1996, and it's valid today. And relative to Scheffler, that was a case that involved a data requester who failed to address his request to the responsible authority. And Your Honor properly quoted the plain words of the statute to him and set his case aside. And I was on that case. I can tell you what I can remember. Relative to damages on identity theft, the commissioner actually warned Mr. Smallwood about identity theft and recommended several remedial measures. And he requested that the commissioner pay for the credit monitoring that the commissioner made necessary. And he was rebuffed. And relative
to- Can I change your attention here for a minute to, you've also got an allegation in the complaint about the vendor kiosk and what provision of the act are you claiming was violated?
Okay.
There. I mean, is that the failure to give him a Tennyson warning? I mean, what's the argument?
Okay. It would be the same thing. A failure to keep secure from unauthorized dissemination. It's under 1305 sub 5. And I'll grant you that the 2018 hack is a more serious a matter than the kiosk.
Can you just ask? I mean, so it's the name, his name, which I assume other people. Yeah, but that's just an identification number. And couldn't he just ask the person to stand back when he's using the kiosk? I mean, I don't know. But that's your claim, is that it's a compelled dissemination. Is that what you're claiming?
It's a compelled dissemination. I'll add, Your Honor, that several cases in Ramsey County have denied dismissal for disseminations before the contract took effect, just on that. I just want to add one quick point on nominal damages. Judge Gruen's decision preceded the Supreme Court's decision on Uzik Bunim, which I brought to the court's attention. And there are many, many nominal damages cases that the Supreme Court has already recognized. And I also brought the court's attention to the TransUnion case, which clearly makes Mr. Smallwood's claims concrete and particular, and he's got standing. And the court should reverse and remand for further proceedings, both for legal relief and for equitable relief. And I see my time's up, but if any judge has questions, I'll answer them now.
Don't see any of our panel members coming forward with any questions. Thank you both for your briefing in this case and your analysis in your oral argument today. Very helpful. I think it helped to clarify some things, a few matters of confusion, but still a very helpful argument, and we appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Arthur.
With that, the matter is submitted, and we will take it under advisement, issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I leave the courtroom with permission of the court.
You certainly have our permission, and we are in recess until our next case.
Thank you.